Thank you. Please be seated. The court is ready to hear argument from Lubbock County.
May it please the court, Ms. Charlotte Bingham will present argument for petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Your Honors, this case involves the application of the statute of limitations to causes of action which are brought against a county and the effect of the presentment statute, which is at the local government code section 89.004, and what effect the presentment statute may have on the statute of limitations and the accrual of a cause of action against a county. The plaintiffs have sued Lubbock County, alleging that they were required to pay certain bail bond fees, and I think this court has visited the issue of bail bond fees in the past in the Camacho versus Samaniego case. The plaintiffs claim that they had to pay bail bond fees for a period of over 7 years until this court issued its opinion in Camacho in 1992. Shortly after the court issued its opinion in Camacho, Lubbock County discontinued its bail bond fees provision, and the plaintiffs filed a lawsuit approximately a year later claiming that they were entitled to recover their fees going all the way back to 1985. The plaintiffs in this case did not present their claim until June of 1993. When they presented their claim, they presented a claim. There were three bail bond companies involved in this. The first plaintiff presented their claim in June of 1993, saying that if you don't return our fees within 30 days, we're going to file suit against you. In August, the plaintiffs, Trammels, did file suit and sought recovery of bail bond fees going all the way back to 1992. Then in approximately a year later, two other bail bond companies, Allstate and Gomez Bail Bond Companies, joined the lawsuit. They had not, however, presented their claim to the Commissioner's Court prior to joining the lawsuit, and in fact did not present a claim to the Commissioner's Court until 1997, which was approximately 3 years after they had filed suit. The Lubbock County filed a motion for summary judgment stating that the statute of limitations barred the recovery of the fees going back any more than 2 years prior to the filing of the suit. And they also filed a motion for summary judgment with regard to the second and third plaintiffs, claiming that they had never presented their claim prior to filing suit and that therefore all of their claims were barred. The district court granted Lubbock County's motion for summary judgment on the basis of the statute of limitations and said that Trammels could not recover their fees for more than 2 years back.
Was that based on limitations or was it based on latches?
The summary judgment opinion stated statute of limitations. And in any event,
is it your view, since the court granted summary judgment based on limitations, that doing so is inconsistent with this court's opinion in City of Taylor versus Hodges, and that City of Taylor versus Hodges must be overruled in order for the trial court's decision to have been correctly based on a limitations defense?
No, I think that you can do one of two things. I think that you can certainly distinguish what happened in the City of Taylor versus Hodges from the facts in this case. And I think that if you'll allow me a minute, I can give you a number of reasons why the City of Taylor versus Hodges can be distinguished.
Okay, would you do that
first
now,
of all, the City of Taylor versus Hodges involves two public entities. And what happened in that case was there was a registrar for birth and death certificates, and the registrar apparently had to make certain payments to the state. But in any event, the City of Taylor paid this registrar, who was a man named Doak, for a certain number of birth and death certificates that got filed. After approximately 2 years of the city, a little bit over 2 years of the city paying this registrar the fees, they discovered that actually the county was responsible for payment of those fees. And so the city asked the county to reimburse them for the fees, and the county declined to do that. The district court, I don't think, even looked at the issue of the presentment statute And I can't remember what the basis for the Court of Appeals opinion, but in any event, in a very one-paragraph line, the Texas Supreme Court said that that the presentment statute precluded the city of, I mean, precluded, it said that the cause of action didn't accrue until the claim was presented and rejected by the commissioner's court.
But that's my problem. I don't understand why why it makes a difference who the parties were in giving that holding.
Well,
that holding seems to be directly on point with the issue that's presented in this case.
Well, for one, I think you can distinguish because there are two public entities, and they make a specific point in there.
Why?
If you look at their language, and I can find that for you, they make a specific point that this would not be the result if the registrar had brought the suit. There's specific language in there where they state, if the period of limitations began to run when the payments were made, and if this were a suit by Doak against the county, then a portion of the recovery would appear to have been barred when the suit was filed. So I can't tell you why they make that distinction, but they very specifically make that point, that the registrar himself could not have brought that suit. And so I think for one reason, that's the first reason that this case is distinguishable, because what we're talking about here is a private entity. We are not talking about the public funds. We're talking about a private entity attempting to recover private funds that they paid to the county. And so that's the first distinction I think that you can make with the city of Taylor versus Hodges. The second distinction that I think you can make with the city of Taylor versus Hodges is that they specifically say that no question of latches is in filing this claim is presented. And I think that if you go back and you look at both the cases that are before and the cases that are after the city of Taylor versus Hodges, the courts have consistently said that if there is some sort of delay in presenting your claim, that is going to bar the application of this rule that you're...
But latches is a separate affirmative defense.
I agree with you.
And what I read Hodges as saying is that here's the rule for limitations, but merely because we would apply this rule for limitations does not preclude a defendant from urging latches as an affirmative defense. And as I understand the later Court of Appeals decisions that come after Hodges, that's why we see latches so frequently discussed, because that's a way of dealing with the accrual rule that is stated in Hodges.
Well, I think, for one, I think that perhaps latches has not been used in its technical, the word latches has not been used in its technical sense as an affirmative defense. I think that it's just being used frequently as synonymous for delay. And I think that you see that in the second Court of Appeals opinion in Camacho.
That's still a separate issue from limitations and the determination of accrual for purposes of deciding when limitations has run.
I agree with you. And actually, I think that one of the main issues in this case is the effect that the plaintiff's interpretation of the presentment statute will have on this court's case law on the issue of accrual, because the presentment statute at 89.004 does not say anything about changing the rules for the accrual of a cause of action, and I think that this court has consistently stated, and the plaintiff cites the same cases that we do that say a cause of action accrues on the date that the injury occurs. There are numerous cases cited in my brief that state that the cause of action that someone has against a county for the return of money accrues at the time that you pay the money.
So you're drawing its distinction between accrual for jurisdictional purposes and accrual for limitations purposes.
No, I think that accrual for jurisdictional purposes and accrual for limitation purposes are exactly the same.
They wouldn't have to be, would they? I mean, we could say that in order to bring suit in court, you have to have presented your claim before as a prerequisite, as a procedural matter to filing a lawsuit. You have to have presented, but that's a separate question from whether the lawsuit is barred by limitations. Couldn't we distinguish Hodges?
I think
on
you
that
could distinguish that. I think that, however, that one thing that the presentment statute does not address at all, the presentment statute doesn't say anything about this statute is going to toll limitations.
No, I'm agreeing with you now. Those are two different concepts.
Exactly. And I think that what the plaintiff is asking you to do is say that the presentment statute does, in fact, have it tolls the statute of limitations. And I think that stands on its head, the whole purpose of a statute of limitations, which is, that we have a societal interest in repose and a societal interest in seeing that claims are adjudicated or brought forward. And that also is completely at odds with the whole purpose of the presentment statute.
But if presentment is a condition precedent to filing suit, then why isn't it just like the requirement under the DTPA that a plaintiff give pre-suit notice, or under the medical malpractice statute that a plaintiff give pre-suit notice? And under both of those statutes and under the law that this court has, the cases that this court has decided interpreting both statutes, a failure to meet the condition precedent tolls the, stops the litigation, abates litigation. Also has a tolling effect for limitations purposes.
I'm not sure that I agree with you on that. I don't believe that the failure to meet a condition precedent stops the statute of limitations for money. I think that the appropriate solution...
It does under the medical malpractice statute.
I believe that the appropriate solution is that if you haven't met a condition precedent, such as under the DTPA or under 4590A, is to abate the litigation so that it can... so that the presentment requirement can be met. But I don't think that affects the date that the statute of limitations accrues or begins to run.
I agree with you. I agree with you on that. The question then becomes, what happens if, in fact, there is no presentment, as is the case with two of the plaintiffs in this case, and they go ahead and file the lawsuit before presenting their claim?
Well,
and your position is that they're just out. That's the end of the line.
Well, I have a little bit of a problem with that because I think that's somewhat inconsistent with my argument that that it's not a jurisdictional prerequisite. And so I think that this could also be resolved simply by saying that this matter was told until after they presented their claim, and that then they would still only, those two plaintiffs would only be allowed to go back to 2 years from the date in which they filed their suit. So I recognize that there is an inconsistency in those positions.
And it's your position that the presentment statute is not a jurisdictional statute?
Absolutely, and I think that's completely consistent with this court's opinion in Essenberg, which is just a few years old and very specifically stated that this is a presentment statute, which is the purpose of which is to provide notice and an opportunity to resolve litigation as opposed to a jurisdictional prerequisite to filing suit, such as you have in the employment discrimination type of statute.
Just as a matter of practice, is that generally the way county government has viewed the presentment statute in practice?
I think that this has not been, as I think you can tell from the sort of the dearth of cases in here, that hasn't really been an issue. I think it's always been the position in county government that you have to bring your claim within 2 years of the date that your cause of action accrues. I mean,
I'm going back to the jurisdictional piece and whether or not the presentment statute is jurisdictional. Has it generally been the practice of county government to treat the presentment statute as a notice and a condition preceding to suit type of statute as opposed to a jurisdictional statute?
I would say that it's been treated differently in different counties, because I think that if you look at some of the cases that came out of Dallas County, I can't remember which of the Bowles cases it was, but there's either Bowles versus Clip or Bowles versus Wade, where the Dallas Court of Appeals did treat it as jurisdictional and said, you didn't present your claim first, you're out. But this court specifically overruled Bowles in the Essenberg case. So I think that issue's probably been treated differently by different counties, and I can't tell you that it's been handled in a consistent manner.
Thank you.
Thank you. I have nothing further.
Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from my respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Knightley will present argument for the respondent.
It is our position on behalf of the bail bond companies in this case that the Court of Appeals decided correctly in following this court's construction of the presentment statute in the City of Taylor case. The only place where we say the Court of Appeals went awry is in failing to grant summary judgment for the bail bond companies for the full amount of the bonds, of the bond service fees that were illegally taken from them.
The trial court granted summary judgment awarding the bail bond, one bail bond company, the fees for the two-year period of time that it determined was not barred.
Prior to the presentment,
and that is contained in the trial court judgment.
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct. And the
and
Court
it
of
gave nothing to the other two.
Correct. Said that they were out completely on limitations by virtue of its construction of the presentment statute as not being a limitations accrual statute. But this court.
So both of the if the accrual rule goes to the ordinary accrual rule as opposed to using presentment as the date of accrual, then do you agree that both of those other bail bond companies would lose, that any attempt to recover fees is outside 2 years?
If you strictly apply the two-year limitation,
right,
the time that the fees were imposed on them, that would be correct.
Okay.
But this court very clearly decided in the City of Taylor case that the presentment statute does constitute a definition of the accrual date for claims against counties, because the statute specifically says you may not sue prior to the time of presentment and rejection or neglect by the county of your claim.
So you can wait 10 years and then present it to the county and say, well, limitations doesn't run until after the county rules. It can be barred by limitations before you ever go to the county, but until the county says no, limitations doesn't run.
That is the way that this court interpreted the statute in City of Taylor, that there is no pre-presentment limitations running, that the accrual of the claim for the purposes of limitations occurs when the county has had an opportunity and has either rejected or neglected to address the claim. That is a specific holding for limitations purposes in suits against counties that this court made very clear in the City of Taylor, in fact made clear in a writ refused case back in 1928, Jones County versus Moore, when there was actually more specific analysis of why that was the case, because the facts that gave rise to the right to bring that case did not exist until the county had been given the opportunity to address the claim. That's what the presentment statute is for. And so this court adopted the Jones County versus Moore decision, cited it with approval again in the City of Taylor case, and specifically held that statute creates a date of accrual for claims against counties. It does create some variance, because it does allow the plaintiff in some circumstances to wait.
Why doesn't it allow the plaintiff in all circumstances to wait?
Well, because there are other doctrines that come into play, such as latches. And that's why we say that the other courts of appeals that have tried to get around the City of Taylor case by using latches as a doctrine have misapplied that doctrine.
They've misapplied latches?
Yes, Your Honor. Because they have said, if you look at the opinions in those cases very carefully, what they say is the limitations period does not accrue until later. But just as a matter of latches, we're going to say that if you're the plaintiff and you are become aware of facts that would allow you otherwise, beyond the presentment statute, to present a claim, to have a claim in court, that you must therefore bring it within the period of limitations. They're glomming basically this latches concept onto a limitations that they're creating out of whole cloth, disregarding the limitations accrual date that this court has indicated was appropriate.
And I understand that the Court of Appeals have used latches as a way of, and grabbed onto the language in Hodges about latches in order to deal with an issue.
Right.
But I thought you just said that latches would be available to prevent a plaintiff from waiting
an inordinate
amount of time.
Latches is certainly a viable affirmative defense. Okay. Unfortunately, in this case, or unfortunately for the county in this case, they didn't present any evidence to support the latches thing other than the passage of time. No, there's no detrimental reliance aspect presented.
Give us an example of the kind of evidence that a county would have to show in order to satisfy the detrimental reliance piece of latches.
I think that they have to show things like that witnesses have died, witnesses are unavailable, records have been destroyed, money has been spent, there's nothing left. I mean, there are a variety of ways that one could show that one has relied on the receipt of those funds to the detriment of the county, that the delay in bringing the claim to get those back has caused them to be unable to defend themselves appropriately. That's not the case here. The amounts of money are fixed. The county, there's testimony that they still have that money. This is money that was illegally taken pursuant to an imposition of a fee that was illegal. It never should have been the county's money.
Well, there was evidence in the record, though, that it was for copying, and the statute does provide for copying and does provide for labor associated with copying. What facts did you present to the contrary?
Well, Your Honor, there really isn't any evidence of any probative value in that regard. First of all, the statute does not, the fee imposition resolution by Lovell County says nothing about the use of the fees. It just says we're going to collect $10 service fee on every bail bond. It doesn't say, and we're going to use that for copying this and that or the other thing. There's no direction that that's the way it's to be used. There's testimony that this was these funds were deposited in the general funds of the county, used for general purposes. There is some testimony that they did perform some services and they made some copies. It's a very weak attempt, frankly, to try to muddy up the record in that regard. But there's no correlation between the resolution that requires the payment of the bond service fee and this very squishy evidence about the fact that they make copies occasionally for bond. There's no evidence of any relationship between those two. There's no evidence of any calculation of how those two relate. They're simply saying, well, geez, we provide these services for bond people. Shouldn't we be allowed to use the fee for that purpose? That's not what the fee was created for.
Under your theory here, when would prejudgment interest begin to run? Is it, can a plaintiff wait, 20 years and get prejudgment interest from the time the fee was collected? From the judgment?
I hadn't thought about that directly, Your Honor, but off the top of my head answer would be, it would be governed by whenever the provision of the prejudgment interest statute says, it's 180 days after notice or the time of filing a suit, whatever it is, whatever the existing rule is at the time
Even though the defendant would have no ability, to hurry up the trial because they're waiting for the plaintiff to present the claim.
Well, there are some strategic advantages to the counties as well. I mean, they can sit on a claim, they can do things to delay themselves, sure, but that, I don't think that changes what this court determined is the accrual date for bringing the claim to court.
Assume with you that you don't have City of Taylor to rely upon, nor do you have Jones County. What argument would you make to get us, in a case of first impression, to adopt the accrual rule that you advance?
That the language of the presentment statute itself suggests that it's not appropriate to go to court until you've given the county an opportunity to address the claim, and that therefore, because the statute says you may not go to court before then, that should be interpreted just as it was in the City of Taylor to mean what it says.
Well, why shouldn't it be interpreted as our other provisions and other statutes like the DTPA and Article 4590I, that in fact that is a condition precedent to suit, and in fact there's no way tied to determining when a cause of action accrues.
I don't know that I have any answer for that, Your Honor, other than what the presentment statute itself has mandated with respect to when it should be brought. The DTPA, for instance, has its own statute of limitations built into the statute. There are other situations where there are limitations periods that are not fixed because of various circumstances, from discovery rule to litigation.
But at the same time, they are separate considerations from the consideration of what may be a condition preceding to suit. They are not one and the same.
That's correct. They're not necessarily one and the same. And I think that Your Honor makes a valid concern.
Is it your view that 89.004 is not a jurisdictional statute?
Yes, Your Honor, it is not a jurisdictional statute. This court, I agree that this court in the Essenberg case so declared when they tried to dismiss a case for lack of jurisdiction because of the failure of presentment. The court said, no, the appropriate remedy is to abate the case, not dismiss the case for lack of jurisdiction. And that's consistent also with the other decisions that we're arguing that the case on behalf of the Gomez Bail Bond Company and the Allstate Bail Bond Company, who joined in the lawsuit, did not make the presentment until while the lawsuit was pending, but the motion for summary judgment by the county was not filed until after that was done. So it was a moot act in terms of abating at that point.
Going back to my question, that we're pretending like this is a case of first impression, that we've never come anywhere near this issue, and you're arguing that we should treat the presentment statute as an accrual statute, what policy reasons would support interpreting the statute as an accrual statute for purposes of limitations as opposed to a condition preceding to suit?
Well, one, it does, I think, legitimately and appropriately give a county the opportunity to review and address a claim before it's brought in court, saving everybody, hopefully, time and expense.
I know, but that fits the condition, that fits the interpreting it as a condition preceding as opposed to, I want you to give me the policy reasons that would favor the interpretation that you would put on the statute that, in fact, it is an accrual statute. In other words, we're going to delay accrual until presentment, as opposed to applying the usual accrual rule that would apply under the statutes of limitations.
Well, I really was trying to address that saying that the policy reason is to allow the counties to have that so that you don't go to court, put the cart before the horse, let the county have the chance to address the claim. Secondly, I would just simply point out, statutes of limitations are a derogation of the substantive rights of the parties. In this case, the right of my clients, our clients, to recover illegally obtained monies by the county. And to the extent that limitations periods, there may be some benefit by having certainty, there's also a loss to the people whose rights, substantive rights, are being affected. And unless there is an absolutely mandated reason by the legislature why a limitations period should preclude a substantive claim, then that should not be something that the court would impose on the parties. And in this case, the court has already decided otherwise under the City of Taylor case. Briefly, again, on our cross petition, the dollars and cents were absolutely clear. The illegality of the collection of the fee was absolutely clear. And there should be a summary judgment for the amount of the bond fees that were illegally obtained in favor of our client.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Your Honors, I would just like to point out that, first of all, Mr. Nicely indicated that latches was that none of the courts, either before or after, actually addressed the issue of when the statute of limitations began to run. And I think that there are a number of cases that are cited in my brief that do, in fact, say that in spite of the Hodges case, that courts of appeals following the Hodges case felt like they could distinguish their facts from Hodges and said that the statute of limitations in claims against a county begin to run at the time the fees are paid. That was both said in the Camacho versus Samaniego case, the second court of appeals opinion in that case, and in either Wade versus Jackson or Jackson County or Jackson versus two Jacksons, unfortunately, that came after this, Wade versus Jackson County, and then there was Jackson versus Tom Green County. And they both specifically stated that the statute of limitations begins to run when you pay your money, and that you have not only a right to file your suit at the time that you pay your money, but a duty, if you want to seek to recover those funds, to go ahead and file your suit at that time. And I think that one of the most important things in this, there's language that goes back 100 years and is used all the way up through the present that deals with this exact situation. And I'm quoting from, I think it's Smith versus Wise County, but it says, it certainly was never contemplated that one having a claim against a county could delay its presentation to the commissioner's court indefinitely and thereby preclude the running of the statute of limitations. There's nothing in the presentment statute that would indicate that you can just hold off and not present your claim for 10, 15, 20 years. I don't know why you would do that, but I think that that goes against public policy to allow somebody to do that, because one of the things that we did mention in our brief is that the counties do have current obligations that they have to meet and certain budgetary requirements and things that they have to do, and that's why it's important for a county to know about the claims that are going to be are pending against it in the period of time, say, within a year or two of them formulating their budget, so that they can be therefore be in compliance with all of the state laws that they have to be in compliance with about what's in the budget and what obligations we have to pay, and so that they can pay their bills. And so I also think that you could find, you know, on the issue of latches and is there any sort of detriment to the county, that you could find that there would be a detriment as a matter of law because of the uncertainty of the county in not knowing what its obligations would be, and then in the county being unable to fulfill its own obligations in terms of what it has to do with regard to its budget.
If we agree with you on the limitations defense, but disagree with you on the pass-on theory that you assert, then was the trial court judgment correct in awarding Trammell 2 years of its fees and nothing to the other two bail bond companies?
If you disagree with us, yes. I mean, if you disagree on the pass-on defense. And I would point out just one point about the pass-on defense. The pass-on defense is actually sort of acknowledged in the Hodges case. The Court of Appeals said that the real party in interest there was not Doak, who actually paid the fees, but was actually the city of Taylor, who was the one that really paid the fees, which is what the bail bond company's clients would be in this case. So just as a point of interest, I think that without actually, you know, saying we're going to apply the pass-on defense, the Hodges Court did in fact do that.
If we disagree with you on the latches defense, does Gomez and Allstate get marched through June of 92?
I believe they do. I mean, I think that if you disagree with us on the latches defense, that there are it's just several months that Gomez and Allstate would be entitled to recover fees for.
Any other questions? Thank you. That concludes the arguments of today's oral submission document. The marshal will adjourn the court.
All rise.